Good morning, I'm Andy Bates. Welcome to Faith and Family. We are broadcasting live from the Doxology Finding Your Voice Conference in St. Louis, Missouri. We're at St. Louis University, and I want to say thanks to our underwriter for this program, Concordia University Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. We can find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin on our website. Just go to kfuo.org and look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining me at the table today here at the Doxology Conference, Dr. Beverly Yonke. She's the Executive Director for Christian Counsel with Doxology. So great to have you back on, Dr. Yonke.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Let me make sure I have your mic up nice and loud so everybody can hear you. It's so nice to have some time to talk about Doxology. Now, you serve as the Executive Director for Christian Counsel with Doxology, and now full-time, is that correct?
As of July 1st, I'm happy to report that I will now be full-time with Doxology, although I will miss my previous nest at Concordia, Wisconsin.
I know. You just finished up your service at Concordia, Wisconsin not too long ago. How long did you serve Concordia, Wisconsin?
I've been there most recently for 5 years, and before going into clinical practice, I had served them for 12 years, so I have long roots and much affection for the people on the campus.
Very good. And your work there, similar field as well, in the psychology and counseling at Concordia University as well, correct?
Largely my responsibilities there were teaching mm-hmm. in the psychology department and seeing if we can help with the formation of a whole new generation of Christian psychologists. Much to do, many mm-hmm. in need.
And now your work with Doxology. I know you've been with Doxology for quite a while. And what is your work as Executive Director for Christian Counsel with Doxology?
In part, my opportunity and responsibility is going to be to determine how we can continue to equip pastors to care for the flock whom God has given them to serve. Our goal is to ensure that pastors understand as under-shepherds, mm-hmm. they have responsibility to care for their own souls, that they need pastors. And one of the things we like to do is provide conferences for pastors. And our classic program allows for pastors to spend a total of 10 days of retreats in three different parts. In the first part of the program, they have an opportunity to spend 4 days in a retreat setting talking about the ancient care of souls, the care of their own soul, how it is that they can most effectively begin to diagnose some of the spiritual ills and woes of those who seek care from them. In the second retreat, we invite pastors to come back, and this time they bring along with them one of the lay leaders of their congregation. Lay leaders participate in the retreat by understanding how they can support their pastor in ministry, how they can assist him to do what it is he is called to do, and have lay leaders assume responsibility for increasing responsibilities of filling potholes, for example, in the parking lot. Ordinarily, we've been happy to discover that lay leaders leave the retreat almost as ambassadors for their pastor, and they go back and talk with boards about our church is ours, and our pastor is ours, and we want to care for him. In the final retreat, pastors and wives come together for a weekend, and they have some additional instruction in terms of pastoral care, as well as an opportunity to look at the nature of marriage and the special challenges and blessings that exist in a stained glass fishbowl.
And marriage is certainly one of the topics being covered at this Finding Our Voice conference today, correct?
Yes. In fact, we've discovered that one of the best things that the Christian community can do is to communicate what we are for instead of what we are against. Mm-hmm. We are for moms, for dads, for traditional conjugal marriage. And we invite our brothers and sisters in Christ to determine how their current relationships might stack up against God's holy word.
And so for this conference, you've gathered together, rounded up some top speakers on the topics. What are some of the topics being addressed today, yesterday and today here at the Doxology Conference?
One of the things we're very interested in discussing is what is the nature of marriage? And so we're, of course, going to look at what the biblical roots of marriage are and what God's expectations and blessings for marriage are. We also, as Christians, need to be equipped to look at how to communicate what we understand to be true mm-hmm. to other people. And a good number of our speakers are assisting us to say it is not necessarily a good thing to remain silent in the face of cultural mischief and cultural mayhem. And a theme throughout our speakers' presentations has been finding our voice. One of our speakers, Sharif Gurgis, from Princeton University, was very straightforward in terms of helping us to say, we don't make proclamations. We talk to the world one person at a time. And ordinarily we do that by reaching out in friendship, not by reaching out in condemnation or in judgment. And we invite individuals to understand what it is we care about, why we care about it, and then talk with them over a period of a year about what God has in mind for marriage and what God has in mind for Christian sexuality. So we're learning to be patient, not simply to drop bomb a message about Christian sexuality and hope that it's going to make immediate change. It's unlikely to. So our speakers are teaching us to cultivate meaningful relationships in which we share the gospel of Jesus Christ, his love, and invite people to ask questions about what have I believed for so long and why do I believe it?
Outstanding. And so, as you mentioned, Sharif Gurgis from Princeton, speaking yesterday mostly,
yes,
I believe, on a number of topics. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk with him in a little bit here about some of the hot button issues. I appreciate that you shared one of his main points, that we don't make proclamations. Rather, we have conversations over a period of time. Why is that so important, and how much more successful is that than making proclamations?
Ordinarily, if we're talking with an individual who is gay or who is very supportive of gay marriage, we have to recognize that they come to us with some firmly fixed attitudes and beliefs. And those of us who study change of attitudes and beliefs recognize when we attack people, they become all the more entrenched in their beliefs, and they're not listening to us. If, however, we take an opportunity to explore what they think, what they feel, what they believe that we're listening to them, and we are, and we're looking for an opportunity to talk with them about some of the errors in their reasoning. We've also discovered, as a result of our speakers, that Christians are very likely to lead with the gospel and to lead with biblical language. And many of our brothers and sisters who are outside of the Christian community don't see the Bible as wisdom literature. They don't see it as God's holy word. And so we're being encouraged to talk about natural law in the public square. People may dismiss God's word to their own peril, but they can't dismiss logic and they can't dismiss reasoning. For example, a man and woman brought together in holy matrimony bring forth wonderful new little people, which is an expression of order, God's order. And some of the things that we've regarded as absolutely normal and natural for centuries are being turned upside down, and we want people to think about that, even if they can't necessarily think about the divine perspective.
Today's conference, not just pastors, but others are attending as well. Lay leaders are attending the conference as well. Have you had a chance to visit with those who are attending the conference about the reason for attending? Why did they sign up? Why did they come? What were they hoping to gain from this conference?
I've enjoyed talking with the lay leaders as well as the pastors. We have a number of teachers who are with us, teachers at the junior high level, at the fifth, sixth grade level, and they're saying, what can I take with me into my classroom? What can I take with me back to my school board? We as a school board at this point aren't even talking about sexuality in our school because parents are afraid of it, and parents don't want their children to learn sexuality from anyone but them. And so teachers are looking for resources. We have grandmas and grandpas who are here. And they may have sons and daughters who are not particularly religious, who are not necessarily raising these grandchildren either in the faith or with an understanding of Christian marriage. And so grandparents are saying, how is it that I am able to reach out to the little ones that I spend time with every weekend and begin to cultivate within them an appreciation for what is godly in terms of being a male and being a female? So everyone seeks something to take home with them to unpack and to share. And that was the goal of the conference, that each finds his voice and is able to go back to their school or their parish or their home or coffee shop and talk with confidence about what it is God has done for us in Christ and what the implications of that are for being male and female in a very confusing culture.
Indeed, it is a confusing culture. Have you heard the response from the participants yesterday, having heard Sharif Girgis and the points that he addressed? What was the response of those who are attending?
Our group has very much enjoyed Sharif Girgis and has found him to be remarkably approachable. He comes to us from a tradition of faith of Roman Catholicism, but truly somebody who honors and respects God and who worships him as we do. And Girgis has been able to move a little bit beyond the theoretical or the deeply theological, and he's saying, what do you say? How can you shape arguments? Mm-hmm. And so he's essentially coaching us on making wise decisions in argumentation with people who may not agree with us at all. And the lay leaders particularly have appreciated the hands-on. How do you do it? How do you say it? And how do you respond? You hate all gay people, don't you? Well, no, we don't.
And that's an assumption, I think, that the rest of the world has, because there are voices who are identified as Christians. There are other brothers and sisters in Christ who have made those proclamations that we were talking about earlier, and done so perhaps with good intentions, but done so in ways that were perhaps more hurtful than helpful.
Sometimes in our zeal to teach about the risen Christ, we become frustrated or angry when others don't respond in ways we might hope, and that defeats our purpose of creating a relationship, because it's in relationships where we see the most change, through conversations. And relationships mean we have to move away from our safe bubble wrap worlds and reach out and befriend others who may not be entirely like us in our beliefs and attitudes and values.
So others, a change that we're anticipating, that we're hoping for, isn't the result of our own doing, isn't the result of our own work. And perhaps that's what's most frustrating. We want to see change happen on our timeline when we're sharing God's word, when we're speaking about Christian marriage. We want to see that change happen in someone's values and attitudes, as you said. We want to see that happen instantly.
And it does, and Sharif Girgis was very insightful yesterday when he pointed to the fact that if we're going to have an opportunity to convince or influence anyone, we can't be their enemy. Mm-hmm. And to influence other individuals, we have to make their acceptance of our position not a failure for them or a loss of face or a matter of shame. Mm-hmm. It has to be, you've thought about these things, I've thought about these things, I'm seeing a little bit more of what you've been telling me about. So it's not a loss to begin to embrace Christian ideology. It's not a failure on their part. And so Sharif Girgis has been particularly useful in saying it is the relationship with other people that allows us to do the most over long periods of time.
It gives us more opportunities to speak the word, and the power is in the word.
And certainly it is, and we trust that God's own spirit is going to be able to work faith and to build faith, mm-hmm. and to convict people of sin where it exists, and to bring them to the word of forgiveness and renewal.
The folks who are attending today, how many, any idea how many are attending the conference today?
I've been told we're over 250. We had hoped for 100 people, and I guess an awful lot of people were curious about what can I say and how might I say it effectively.
How do I find my voice? Where can I find my voice when talking about Christian marriage and the vocations of husband and wife, moms and dads? Where do we find that? I'm sure that's a question that many have today. As we go out from this place, as we wrap up the conference later on today, correct?
Right, this afternoon.
As we wrap up the conference, what are you hoping that participants will leave here with? How will they be equipped? What is your hope?
My hope is that individuals will have been encouraged in the mm-hmm. conversations we've had here, that they will have been fortified with both information as well as some strategies to take back to their parish and their schools. I think that those who may still be a bit reluctant about finding their voice and speaking up might nevertheless return to their schools and be asking questions of their pastor, mm-hmm. of their teachers, of their school board. What are we teaching about Christian sexuality? When in the curriculum are we talking about marriage? And what is it our children are taking home? So having informed people with excellent questions to ask is going to invite an awful lot of people to review what they're doing and perhaps to stretch them in ways that will be very healthy.
This is just one of the this conference is just one of the programs that Doxology offers. And earlier you were sharing with us about the efforts of Doxology to equip pastors, but also lay leaders in the congregation as well. What other opportunities lie ahead this year?
I would invite all of your listeners to go to Doxology's Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And on Facebook, you will find a number of announcements about the programs that are coming up in September and in October. We are particularly interested in having individuals from congregations attend our Encore Retreat, which is, again, the lay leader retreat where pastors and people mm-hmm. together learn about how they can partner and teach God's Word faithfully within and with outside the congregation.
Well, very good. The Facebook page, Doxology Facebook page, you can find more information there. The website, doxology.us as well. Anything else you want to share with us about the conference as we wrap up our time together today?
I would encourage people to move away from head-wagging and hand-wringing. It's mm-hmm. a time where we might feel as if we've been defeated after the Supreme Court decision mm-hmm. made in June. And we recognize that the culture is not going to become easier, but we need to be pointed towards the goal, and the goal is to continually be drawn and renewed by God's Word, and confident that He will bless and keep His church, even in the midst of what appear to be some rather significant challenges.
Thank you very much. Dr. Beverly Yonke, Executive Director for Christian Counsel with Doxology, thank you for being my guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming to the conference and enjoying the presentations.
My pleasure. We are broadcasting live from St. Louis University here at Worldwide KFUO in St. Louis. We're broadcasting from the Doxology Conference. We'll continue Faith and Family right after this break on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
Back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We are broadcasting live from the Doxology Conference at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri. And the Finding Our Voice Conference, addressing topics of marriage and family. And the keynote speaker today, Sharif Girgis, spoke primarily yesterday, and joining us at the table today, grew up in Delaware, majored in philosophy at Princeton, and now continuing 2 degrees, I believe, at one time. Sharif, welcome back to Faith and Family. Glad to have you with us on KFUO today.
Thanks for having me.
Sharif, tell us a little bit about your background. I know we had a chance to talk a few months ago about your involvement in this conference, but why are these issues important to you? Tell us about your background.
Sure. Well, I, as you mentioned, I've studied philosophy as an undergrad and later in graduate school, and got involved in the marriage debate and the debate about marriage and sexuality in general. Partly through that, and just realizing how poorly the debate was going as a national conversation. People on one side were using intimidation and name-calling. People on the other side were desperate for an explanation for their own views and sometimes reaching for sort of lackluster arguments. Oh, it's just always been this way or something. And that's really what got me involved.
And so presenting twice at this conference, some of the topics, I know, hot button issues. What are the, I have an idea of what I think the hot button issues are, but from your perspective, what are the hot button issues?
Sure. Well, the focus of the conference was marriage and sexuality, and we were talking about the particular issues that that surround that. So same-sex relationships being recognized as marriages, and now increasingly other types of relationships, multiple partner and so on. We're talking about sex ethics, about the moral status of same-sex sexual relationships, sex outside of marriage, the nature of marriage, why it matters for the common good, and then, of course, issues related to reproduction and parenting that surround that, abortion, adoption, and so on.
And I had the opportunity to talk with Dr. Yonke just a little bit ago, and she shared your approach to discussing these issues, that it takes time. It's not something that we make proclamations or speaking harshly publicly, but rather taking time, building relationships, having conversations over a year, not expecting a result within a 20-minute conversation.
Absolutely. Some of the things I was saying was that the best context for these conversations is a friendship where people are motivated to care about the issue if they don't already mm-hmm. care because they're motivated because their friend cares, where they're motivated to give everything you say the most charitable interpretation that they can, and where they feel like it wouldn't be a violation of their pride to give in. It wouldn't feel like mm-hmm. giving in. It would feel like joining in if they came to agree with you on the particular issue. And I think those are just really difficult circumstances to have unless it's an ongoing relationship where there's talk about this and about other things, where your commitment to the other person is unconditional and they know it.
It's refreshing to have a young person who to address these issues. I mean, look at the crowd here. We have a lot of pastors and lay leaders as well. And it's, in terms of age, the audience, it's a broad spectrum, but you're probably one of the youngest people here. It's refreshing to have a young person addressing this. Do you think that it is important to young adults today to think through these topics of marriage and sexuality, to really give them thought? Or do you think when it comes to young adults in American culture today, we really don't give it a lot of thought? We just go with whatever the current trend is in culture.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to think about it, but it's not been important to us mm-hmm. so far. It's really crucial. I think it's crucial for our own lives as we're dating, figuring out what to find in a spouse, making decisions about that, and then, of course, beginning our marriages and our families. It's also crucial because it's just pivotal to every aspect of the common good. Anybody who, and people in our age are, to various extents, politically engaged. So any of the issues that could possibly get them into politics, whether it's health or education or welfare in any other respect, mm-hmm. is going to have a connection to marriage and to the public understanding of marriage. So there's every reason to be involved. And I think the other thing that's going on is that people in my generation are a little disillusioned about marriage. We've seen the baby boomer generation mm-hmm. mess it up in a lot of ways, no offense to baby boomer listeners. And I think that has led us to be a little bit disaffected. We have to get engaged and we have to think about this because marriage isn't going away. It's only going to go better or worse.
Do you have friends who were rejoicing over the recent Supreme Court decision? How do you engage in conversation regarding that? As they're happy, this is in from their perspective, this is a good thing. This is progress.
Yeah, well, definitely most of my friends feel that way. I think there's some common ground I can begin with them. You know, of course, some of the things they're celebrating, I can celebrate too. They're celebrating the fact that in their view, their friends in the LGBT community have been told, hey, you count just the same as us. Well, I agree that they count just the same as us, and I am glad. If it took this decision, I don't think it should have taken this decision mm-hmm. to send them that signal, but I'm glad that they got the signal if they got it. They are worried about loneliness. I can say to them, you know what, I agree. That was clearly in Justice Kennedy's own opinion. I can say, I agree, loneliness is terrible. I actually think this vision of marriage that says marriage is just intimacy and any time you have intimacy you have to have sex in marriage, that might reinforce loneliness for people who remain single for whatever reason. So I can begin with the things that they're celebrating, acknowledge the parts I share, and go from there.
How do you, let's take loneliness as an issue that some would say, the same-sex marriage is important because we don't want our friends, our gay friends, to experience loneliness. They deserve to have someone in their lives for the rest of their lives to care for them.
Yeah, I think the key error here is to think that marriage and companionship are the same thing. And anytime you have companionship, you have to have sex and public status, which is and a marriage in every respect that you can. I think that's a pernicious idea. It's a very modern idea. The truth is that we can find deep and fulfilling relationships, plumb each other for advice, have even a go-to person, so to speak, who knows whenever your plane is going to land, who knows who everyone else goes to when you haven't been yourself. They want to know if you're doing well. I think all of that, we have to open up our imagination and our understanding and see that those kinds of relationships historically have been possible and still are possible without a sexual or romantic or marital component to them. And once we do, then we can be free to use marriage for a more specific, and if I might even say a more mundane purpose, which is the purpose that it serves better when it's exclusively focused on it, which is creating the conditions under which kids can be reared with their own mother and father. So linking kids to their own parents.
Do you think our society's continual movement toward individualism, that everything is about the individual, is the main reason for just what you described, that we think that companionship has to involve romance and sex?
Yeah, I think these things are definitely related. There's some sociologist, Andrew Cherlin, who supports same-sex marriage actually as a policy matter, says that there's a kind of expressive individualism that's been shaping not just the same-sex marriage debate, but no-fault divorce and so on. It focuses on marriage as a kind of soulmate relationship for your own personal satisfaction. And when it's no longer satisfying you, it's inauthentic and pointless to stick with it. Now, that is a vision. That's not just a gay or straight issue. That's a vision that opposite-sex couples in many cases are also shaped by. And it's just not one that's going to sustain the stabilizing norms of permanence and exclusivity that serve family life and the common good.
So if we lived in a culture that perhaps was more family and community oriented, for example, in the congregation, in the local congregation where we care for one another, as you were talking about that care when someone is, needs someone to come pick you up from your flight, whatever time your flight arrives. When we have that sense of community, whether it's in a congregation or another setting, then we can focus on those other marriage being that truly intimate relationship in the environment for raising a family, for children to be reared up with a mother and father.
I think that's absolutely right. We need to model the possibility for people who aren't in a marital or sexual relationship to have deep and fulfilling bonds. And the church, above all, I mean, should be in a position to do this. We have, by our own lights, the deepest kind of communion possible. Now we have to start acting like it.
Well, what lies ahead for Sharif Girgis? I know speaking at this conference is certainly, we're grateful for it, and so glad that you could make the time to be here and present to us. What lies ahead? You're working on 2 degrees at the same time, as I understand.
I am, yep. I'm hoping to finish the law degree this year, the PhD soon after that, and then throw myself on the mercies of the job market in academic life.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today here at Worldwide KFUO and for presenting the conference. I've heard great things from those who are attending already. It's already going viral on Facebook.
So. Great. Good to hear. Thank you.
Sharif Girgis, thank you so much for being our guest on Faith and Family.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up in just a little bit, we'll continue our conversations here at the Doxology Conference. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. Listening to Faith and Family, I'm Andy Bates. We are broadcasting live from the Doxology Finding Your Voice, Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University. And joining me at the table now, the Reverend Dr. John Kleining, Professor Emeritus at Luther College in Melbourne, Australia.
Adelaide.
I'm sorry, in Adelaide.
Yes.
All right. Well, Dr. Kleining, welcome to Faith and Family. It's great to have you with us today. And you served as a presenter here at the conference, and we'll talk more about your topic here in a little bit. But I'd love to share a little bit about your history as a pastor and as a professor with our listeners today. So where did it all begin? You studied at seminary in Australia?
Yes, I studied in Adelaide after completing university, where I did a degree in German literature, did seminary, and then after seminary I graduated and had my first call as a chaplain and pastor to a Lutheran high school in Melbourne. That was 4 years, and after that as a senior chaplain and co-pastor at St. Peter's Lutheran College and the congregation attached to it, which is Resurrection Lutheran Church. After that, then, I was called by the church to study, to prepare for tertiary teaching, and I spent my first time in Cambridge and got my first degree in Cambridge. After that, then, I started teaching at our seminary in Adelaide. And that began in 1982, and I'm now retired.
And now retired, but serving as a speaker at the Doxology Conference on the beauty of chastity and reclaiming sexual virtue. Is that right?
Yes, and also on the beauty of marriage, and I presented 6 different models or views on marriage.
Now, it sounds like most of your career has been in Australia. What are some of the differences in terms of perspectives on marriage and family from American culture and Australian culture?
It's hard to pin down exactly, mm-hmm. but we have a... There's a lot that's superficially very similar, and yet we have significant differences. Our political system mm-hmm. is Westminster. It's much more like Great Britain. We don't have any Bill of Rights, thank God. The Supreme Court works completely differently. We don't have any president. The Prime Minister is a member of Parliament, and he is not elected by people, but he's elected by the party that he is part of. And... Okay, that's one difference. So there's a political difference. There's also a historical difference, which is significant. You were founded basically by religious refugees coming mm-hmm. from Great Britain, and that continued then and set the tone for your culture. And those initial religious refugees put their stamp on the USA and put religion right in the center of the public domain. Now, this is not the same in Australia. We were founded as a series of convict colonies. and those convicts have shaped our values. So one of the most significant Australian values is mateship and fairness, but particularly mateship. Also, as a result of that, we've never had the American kind of Puritanism, nor the reaction to it in the present day with the kind of decadence that you get here, which is the reflex of Puritanism.
So there seem to be, from what I'm hearing you say, is there aren't a lot of extremes.
Yes, that's the way it tends to be in our system. What struck me immediately the first time I came here to the USA was the way people polarized politically, mm-hmm. socially, and in the church. In Australia, if you go to any extremes, left or right or whatever the extremes are, you lose most people. There's a natural instinct in our psyche of going to the middle ground. Now, this is very healthy, and there are certain voices which are basically trying to polarize people, but to the present, to some extent, not entirely successfully. And this is also the case in the church, and particularly our Lutheran church in Australia. You don't get the same sort of polarization politically, mm-hmm. Theologically.
When it comes to marriage, how is marriage regarded? What has the issue, for example, of same-sex marriage, how is that regarded in Australian culture?
There's a difference between the chattering classes, the cultural elite, mm-hmm. and the rank-and-file people. Yes, it's come across as an agenda from everywhere in the Western world. So there's a big push everywhere in the media for recognition of homosexuality and same-sex marriage. They have captured a great deal of the prominent part of the cultural, the cultural fortresses. So, for example, just this last week, or a week ago, the Labour Party, which is our Democrats, officially voted to that same-sex marriage should be part of their policy. However, they were still forced to make it a matter then of allowing conscientious objection in any of their members. On the other hand, a few days later, the Liberal Party, who are our Conservatives, right, because they're classical liberals, emphasising freedom, reiterated the party's commitment to prohibiting same-sex marriage. So it makes for an interesting mix. Now, how long the Liberal Party can hold out on this remains to be seen, because there's enormous cultural pressure against them. So that's the cultural elite. On the other hand, the rank and file, ordinary Australian, who we call the Aussie bloke, regards it to some extent with disdain and abhorrence.
And so how do you address this then, this topic of marriage? How do you speak of it in the Christian context? How do you speak of it in the church? How do you speak of it in conversations, as Sharif was speaking of? How do you speak about it?
I think we need to distinguish between two different audiences. First of all, in the public domain. And this is what's critical at the present moment. To some extent, there's a kind of what you'd call a liberal elite has captured the strongholds of our society and has denigrated the church and is very anti-Christian, particularly anti-Catholic, and with that then anti-Lutheran, but we don't really rate on the public agenda. But it's very anti-Catholic. And the basic message that they have very successfully promoted in a thousand different ways, that Christians are anti-sex. They disapprove of sex. And that Christians are sexual killjoys. Right? So, whereas, you know, we are pro-sex, Christians are anti-sex. That's a simple, crude framing of the public debate. So, in that context, it's very important for us to speak in with a positive voice, not to get angry and shrill and to make asses of ourselves because we throw bombs at them, but to present a positive picture of sex and marriage. And so this is one of my aims, for example, in both of my presentations. The first one is to speak about the beauty of marriage. And then the one that I'm going to do this afternoon is the beauty of chastity. And to give people a vision of the beauty of these things. Because this is particularly important in Australia, and I gather also here in the USA, getting a hearing from the so-called millennials, Y generation and millennials, no, that's to speak in sociological terms, who are very much motivated by, among other things, ecology and beauty. And so to appeal to the beauty of these things, you will immediately get a hearing. But if you go into negative mode, they'll switch off straight away.
So give us some examples from the beauty of marriage. How did you approach that topic? How would you approach that topic with millennials?
There's a difference between the way I approached it here in the conference and how I would approach it to millennials. Okay, if I can just give you one example about the millennials and a little bit earlier already, XY generations. I officiated at the wedding of my oldest daughter. Her husband comes from a conscientious agnostic family. They work politically. He was a legal draftsman in Canberra. That's our capital. And many of their friends were not Christians, and some were quite anti-Christian. And I knew that. And so I decided to preach on Ephesians 5 and the mystery of marriage. The mystery of marriage as a natural mystery, a state of being that you are drawn into, and you're drawn into something bigger than just a personal relationship. And then the supernatural mystery of marriage as mirroring the union of Christ and his holy bride, the church. Okay, at the end of the marriage, a guy, you know, mid-late 20s, approached me and made himself known to me. And he said, hey, that was great. And he gave me his name and asked his connection. And then I said, are you married? He says, no. But that's my partner over there. And they're our two children. He said, okay, yeah, but you've got me thinking. I think that we need to decide, to talk about, that's as far as you go with me, talk about getting married. And why was that? It was because I had presented something of the beauty of marriage, its natural beauty, as a mystery. Now, mystery is something that you can't, is accessible, but you can't explain, and you can't explain away. It's something bigger than you that you need to be initiated into, and that initiates you into something bigger than yourself. But also the beauty of a Christian marriage. So that's one way. So
sure.
Millennials, people say, are moved by four things. You know, there's no great order: justice, beauty, mystery, community. Now, in my presentation here yesterday, I gave six different models of marriage. The first were three different kinds of relationship, and then the last three were three different kinds of states of being, orders. And the second one I gave particular emphasis to, that it is an ecological order, that it's part of God's ecology, the ecological order that God has created, that's described in Genesis. And marriage is part of this order. It's a natural order. Now, I did that because I found that that metaphor appeals to most young people who are fascinated by the natural order and are horrified by natural disorder.
I would think in American culture, many would ask where this order comes from, and if they find that it's from the Bible, if they find it's from that, then they wouldn't have nearly the regard for it. I don't know if they would necessarily see it as beautiful.
That's right. And so you get the immediate switch off. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're just Bible bashing.
Right.
What we need to learn to do marriage, sexuality, is part of the order of nature.
Mm.
It's a given. Human beings don't make marriage. Governments, above all, don't create marriage. It's given. And it's always been there, as far as recorded history can go. And there is a evident order to it, which is something like the order that we discover in the natural world. Obviously, sex is sexual reproduction is something that we have in common with the animals, at least through sexual intercourse. But reproduction is part that something that we have in common with all living creatures. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the natural order. And that's a good starting point from which you can establish then the nature of marriage and the purpose of marriage and the blessings, the good things that come from respecting the order and the bad things that come from spurning and disregarding the order and the way that disorder then in part of the whole, say, between one man and a woman, has a ripple effect through the whole of society, but also affects the natural world.
So then, when addressing the beauty of chastity, how do you address that then with millennials especially? Where do you find that in natural order?
Yes, and I'm going to speak about it both from a moral point of view, which is a natural point of view, and a theological point of view. And I start off then by saying that sexual intercourse is not just a matter of doing something with your body. It involves the whole of you. It's, in fact, and anybody who has anything to do with it knows that it's as much a matter of the mind and the imagination and desire as it is to do with the senses, the physical senses and the body. When you have sexual intercourse, you don't just exchange bodily fluid, put it that way, but you give yourself to another person. And you give sex is not just doing something with the body, but giving yourself to a person of the opposite sex. And it works best, and everybody's the intuition of that, is that you need to give yourself completely. Not just physically, but also mentally and emotionally, in every possible way. And chastity comes out of that then, which is that has to do with sexual fidelity and sexual intercourse is self-giving, that you give yourself to another person, not just at one moment, but you remain given to the other person. You can't do that completely or wholeheartedly or unreservedly unless you have yourself to give. So if you've given yourself to this and that 100 people, there's no single self to give. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is that your sense of self...
Yeah, I'll help you. There we go.
It's a catastrophe.
It's all right. It happens when we're broadcasting.
Your sense of self disintegrates. Mm-hmm. You lose your personal integrity, the sense of wholeness. Deep personalized sex, which is casual sex, depersonalizes the person.
And so the person, the identity is even changed or lost.
Eroded, mm-hmm. yes. It can lead to being changed or lost, particularly if people engage in sexual intercourse before they have a firm sense of themselves, their own identity. It's very threatening and very destructive to an immature person. And very few people have a sure sense of themselves, even when they're adult these days. It's a perilous encounter. And so people reserve themselves so that they won't be hurt. They reserve their personal side and just have depersonalized sex.
As a professor, as a seminary professor, a college professor, how do you prepare your students for these topics, for addressing these topics in their lives, in classrooms, in the parish, in their families at home?
Well, it depends on what subject you teach. My area is Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's to emphasize the teaching of this. Say when I teach Genesis 1, or I teach God's covenant with his people as compared to a marriage, and the idolatry as compared to sexual adultery. So to make use of these biblical resources and to equip students with the biblical teaching of marriage, because that for pastors is absolutely foundational. That's where I teach it. Now, if I was teaching pastoral theology, I would do it differently, and you know, ministry to young people and family and so on. But the other area where I touch upon it, traditionally in my teaching, is I teach spirituality. And that's very important then for in a discussion on holiness and sanctification.
Reverend Dr. John Klenig, Professor Emeritus at Luther College in Adelaide, South Australia. Thank you so much today for spending time talking with us and sharing with us about your presentation here at the conference. It's been a privilege and an honor to get to speak with you today.
It's been lovely. Thanks ever so much, Andy.
God's blessings. Well, that does it for me and our live broadcast at the Doxology Conference today. I'll send it back to you in the studio, Buzz. Thanks for keeping things running there. Coming up next, Thy Strong Word on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.